Hello, everyone, and welcome to Episode 3, Season 5 of Controversy and Clarity, a podcast of the Warfighting Society. I'm your host, Damian O'Connell. We're briefly stepping away from our Squad Leader series to feature a very special guest, Mr. Fred Smith, the founder and chairman of the board of FedEx and former Marine infantry officer, joins us to share some of his experiences and insights on topics from combat leadership to how AI is changing our world. Our conversation is brief compared to most of our episodes, but I think you'll agree that Mr. Smith wasted no time, providing lots of wisdom and food for thought on challenges and topics relevant to any leader, regardless of domain or industry. Here's Mr. Smith's bio. Born in 1944 in Marks, Mississippi, Frederick W. Smith is the founder of FedEx Corporation and executive chairman of the board of directors. He served 4 years in the Marine Corps, including two tours of duty in Vietnam. During his first tour, he served with 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines. His billets included Rifle Platoon Commander twice, 81mm Mortar Platoon Commander, Rifle Company XO, and Rifle Company Commander. During his second tour, he served as a forward air controller. For his actions in Vietnam, he received the Silver Star, Bronze Star, and 2 Purple Hearts. After leaving the Marines, he launched the original Air Ground Federal Express Network, which began operations in 1973. FedEx served the rapidly growing high-tech, high-value-added sectors of the economy that Mr. Smith had predicted as an undergraduate at Yale, his alma mater. FedEx has since grown into a global enterprise that serves more than 220 countries and territories. As executive chairman, Mr. Smith focuses on board governance as well as issues of global importance, including sustainability, innovation, and public policy. Mr. Smith is a trustee for the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a member of both the Business Council and Business Roundtable. He served as chairman of the U.S.-China Business Council and co-chair of the French-American Business Council. He has served on the boards of several large public corporations, Malone & Hyde, AutoZone, First Tennessee, Holiday Inn, E.W. Scripps, and General Mills, and charitable organizations including St. Jude Children's Research Hospital and the Mayo Foundation. He has received several honorary degrees and numerous civic, academic, and business awards, including the Global Leadership Award from the U.S.-India Business Council and the Circle of Honor Award from the Congressional Medal of Honor Foundation. In addition, Mr. Smith is a member of the Aviation Hall of Fame and the Business Hall of Fame. He served as co-chairman of the U.S. World War II Memorial Project and the campaign for the National Museum of the Marine Corps. He was cited in Forbes' 100 Greatest Living Business Minds and has been named a top CEO by both Barron's and Chief Executive magazines. In our conversation, Mr. Smith mentioned several books. We've included links to those in the show notes. Be sure to check them out. Finally, I hope this episode, like all our episodes, encourages listeners, especially service members, to discuss and debate the topics mentioned and to strive to become better at your profession. So without further ado, here's our conversation with Mr. Fred Smith. Enjoy. Sir, Mr. Smith, it is an absolute privilege and honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much for making the time.
Glad to be here.
So, sir, I'd like to get into your experiences in Vietnam. And the first question is, reflecting on your time in Vietnam, what memories or experiences stand out most?
Well, you know, I'll be 80 this summer, so sometimes I can remember things that happened in Vietnam just like they're yesterday, and sometimes they fade from my mind, which is the perils of getting old. But let's just put it this way. It was a hard way to make a living, I can promise you that. And the way the war was prosecuted in retrospect was unfortunate, in my opinion. The search and destroy strategy, which was pursued by General Westmoreland. But suffice it to say, we had a lot of fights in the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines during its deployment in Vietnam and during my time with the battalion. So it was a life-defining experience, and what I learned in the Marine Corps in general and through my training and leadership training, and particularly what I experienced in Vietnam, was really the defining moments of my life, which I was heavily influenced by in my later business career.
If we could drill deeper into your time with 3-5, you joined India Company 3-5 in mid-May 1967. You joined as a platoon commander. What was it like taking command of your platoon? And what do you recall about initial challenges you faced and how you navigated them?
Well, one of the things that was fairly shocking about my joining 3-5 in May of 67 is we were required to go through Okinawa And the Marine Corps' tour of duty in Vietnam was 13 months, and the Army's was 12 months, I think in part because the Marine Corps' philosophy was to take people through Okinawa, and there was supposed to be a three-day indoctrination course there. Well, I was originally assigned to the 3rd Marine Division, but the 1st Marine Division had a significant number of casualties on Operation Union and Union 2. So they came in not long after we had laid our sea bags down in Okinawa and said, get on the GVs, you're going down to Chulai. And so I don't even think we spent a night there, maybe one night. So we didn't have the indoctrination because they needed people up front. And they switched me from 3rd Marine Division to the 1st Division. And I actually joined my unit, my platoon in the field. I met with the regimental commander, who was quite a colorful officer. And that night I joined my platoon that was already deployed in the field. So it was sort of stunning to come from CONUS, United States, and be with my rifle platoon in about 48 hours. All I did was drop my sea bag and get my 782 gear and helmet and rifle and went to the field.
What do you recall about the platoon when you first meet them? I mean, it's night, so I'm sure it's a little hard to get acclimated and know who's who, but, you know, are they in defensive positions?
Well, they were in a defensive position for sure, because every night you dug a fighting hole, because if you didn't dig a fighting hole and an incoming mortar came in, that, you know, and you didn't have a place to roll into, it could be a bad situation, to say the least. So I joined my platoon at night, and as I said, it was really fairly stunning because they'd been fighting that day, and there were a lot of artifacts of the fighting that day. So it was, I can remember thinking, my God, if it's like this every day for 13 months, I don't know whether I'm going to be able
to do this.
But, and it was quite a few days like that. But of course, you had days of, you know, just drudgery and patrolling and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But that's how I joined my platoon in 3-5, initially India Company.
Do you recall any initial command challenges, tough decisions, anything like that?
Well, I had a great group of Marines, and the battalion commander I admired greatly, Colonel Webster. I worked for an extremely tough guy. And over the course of my time in 3-5, I served in India. I took over 80 81s. I was XO platoon leader in Lima Company, and eventually became the CO of K-35 in late 1967, which I had through June of 68. So as a first lieutenant, I had the honor and responsibility of being a company commander. There were a lot of challenges, I mean, but I was well trained for it. I knew my business. And in Vietnam, the secret was to be very judicious as to how you deployed your troops and not get any people out in a position where they could, you know, be surprised or get hurt. Fortunately, that never happened to me, but it happened to our battalion on several occasions. And then probably most importantly was to understand how to use our supporting arms with great precision, because that was our advantage. The North Vietnamese Army, which were the troops which we were mostly facing up in what was called I Corps, the northern part of the Republic of Vietnam. They were very, very tough troops. They were the best army in the world at the time, as they showed in 1979 when the Chinese came down after we had left and the North Vietnamese beat the hell out of them. And they had NCOs that had been fighting for 20 years, first the French and then us, and then later on the Chinese. So they were terrific soldiers, and I admired them. I didn't like them, but I admired them a lot because they were great infantry.
So in your 13 months with 3-5, you're a rifle platoon commander, you're an 81s platoon commander, you're a company XO, and then a rifle company commander. That's a lot of, you know, it's several different billets in pretty short amount of time. Did you find that your experience as far as rotating through these different billets or being assigned to these different billets, was that unique compared to your peers, or was that pretty normal as far as a first lieutenant's experience in the battalion while you were there?
Well, I'm saying this with a little bit of humor, but I always thought that I was expendable because I was a USMCR and not one of the career guys. So the reality is a lot of the company grade officers would spend 6 to 8 months in the field, and then they would go back to a, you know, staff position or some sort of position on the battalion or regimental staff or something like that. So I had the pleasure of doing that for 1 week. I was the S4 for 1 week. And we were so short of officers, and I was greatly honored by this. They made me a company commander as a first lieutenant.
Yeah.
And just like I had been as a platoon leader, I was blessed to have a great NCO, Staff Sergeant Jackson, when I first joined India. And then I had a couple of very, very good gunnery sergeants, particularly Gunnery Alan Sora. And they knew the ropes, and they had a lot of years in the Marine Corps. They were very helpful to me in a lot of different ways. But by the time I had K-3-5, I knew what the score was pretty well, because having been a platoon leader, which is a more treacherous job than company commander because they're more up front. And as I said a moment ago, I tried very hard not to get my guys hurt and to expend the government's money on ordnance instead of getting them hurt. And the search and destroy strategy that General Westmoreland pursued was essentially using American troops to go find a fight, Army and Marines. And we found a lot of them. And the casualty lists show that. And then to be able to use our supporting arms, and I don't know of any instance where American units, except very small ones, which might have been decimated by an ambush or being in the wrong place at the wrong time or something like that, I don't know of any significant engagement where the American forces didn't, quote, win, and meaning there were a lot more enemy casualties than we experience. But as a congressman one time told General Westmoreland, who famously said, well, we're taking down 10 of the enemy to one of ours, the congressman told him, said, well, the people in America don't care about the 10, General, they care about the one. Mm-hmm. So that's why, in retrospect, the strategy, I think, was not the best. The Marine Corps had a different strategy early on, the combined action platoons, which was pushed by General Krulak. But that was not the strategy that was pursued for most of the war. And then when President Nixon got in, he started interdicting the supply lines and using the B-52s up north, which is really what brought the conflict to a close.
So if we could go back to your staff NCOs, and starting first with your first platoon sergeant, Staff Sergeant Richard Jackson. You've said about him elsewhere that, quote, without his leadership, advice, and friendship over that summer, end quote, you'd probably not be alive. Staff Sergeant Jackson was killed in action on 6 September 1967, I believe, during Operation Swift. Could you just tell us a little more about what sort of leader, what sort of Marine he was, and if there are any specific memories or experiences you have that highlight who he was and his impact on you?
Well, Jack, as I called him, was he was a career Marine. You know, I guess in retrospect, he wasn't that much older than I was, but he seemed like, a generation older, but he had been around the Marine Corps. The troops couldn't fool him. They, tried their best because he had been there and done that. He knew his work well in terms of the tactics and the little details about running an infantry organization at the platoon level. And he was very helpful to me in terms of, I think, the leadership that I employed with my platoon and later on with the company, just as to what was effective with the troops and what was not. And so, as I said, I think about him all the time. And I sent to you prior to this interview a Veterans Day speech I gave in 2022 on the 40th anniversary of the Vietnam Veterans Wall. And I talk about six people in there: my friend Dick Pershing, college pal who died with the 101 during the Tet battles. Grandfather was General Blackjack Pershing. He's buried on the top of Arlington Cemetery next to his grandfather. Then Sergeant Jackson, Joe Campbell, and Jack Ruggles, who had been two of my platoon leaders. And then Hank Kolakowski, who was a great friend of mine, Naval Academy guy, senior captain, although we were peers. He had, as I recall at the time, maybe India Company, and I had K Company on Operation Allenbrook. And then most notably, our chaplain, Father Vincent Capodanno. Vince was a wonderful guy. He had absolutely forbidden to go out on anything other than a battalion operation. He was off and off with squads on nighttime patrols, and he's a Medal of Honor man. He's the only Navy chaplain to ever receive the Medal of Honor for service with the Marines. There have been others that received medals of honor. There's a great book about him, and the author interviewed me about Father Capodanno called The Grunt Padre, and I'd recommend that to any Marine if you want to be inspired. Vince Capodanno's life and what he did in Vietnam will inspire you, I promise you.
Thank you, sir. If we could just spend a few moments talking about your company gunnery sergeant. So you take over Kilo 3-5. Your company gunnery sergeant at the time is Gunnery Sergeant Alan Sora, someone you described as, quote, courageous, savvy, and who similarly saved my rear end on more than one occasion, end quote. Yeah. What influence did he have on you? What did you take away from the gunnery sergeant?
Well, it was impossible to be scared around Gunny Sora. I mean, he would stand up and, you know, kind of yell and scream at the troops. He was absolutely fearless. And he was a great friend and, again, a great mentor. And I use that word knowingly because the NCOs are the backbone of the Marine Corps. Everybody knows it. They're the backbone of all the services, but I think particularly in the Marine Corps. One of my platoon leaders was a sergeant, Dave Danford. He stayed in and ended up as sergeant major, who I always say was one notch above commandant in terms of rank in the Marine Corps. And we've stayed in touch. He's a great golfer. He's come to Memphis, visited my house. We went to the Marine Corps Museum when it opened up. So I just had a lot of NCOs that were just outstanding. And Gunnery Sergeant Sora was top flight in every respect.
Sir, you lost several subordinate leaders while you were a company commander, and I think also as a platoon commander. Two of the lieutenants, I think you mentioned already, Jack Ruggles and Joe Campbell. How did you cope with their loss, and what advice would you give commanders today about dealing with the loss of subordinate leaders, whether it's a squad leader, a platoon commander, anything like that?
Well, unfortunately, the currency of war are trading lives and property. And if you're not prepared to deal with that, you probably shouldn't have gone in the service to begin with. I get the request to interview and then recommend youngsters that are going to the service academies. And I always bring them in and remind them that it's not just the free education and the parades and the fine uniforms that is involved in going to the service academy. Essentially, you're raising your hand saying, if the bell goes off, I'm willing up to, and including the loss of my own life, to rain death and destruction down on the enemies of the United States to achieve its objectives, whatever they may be. So war is a moral issue. And I think in retrospect, I was very heavily influenced. I had six relatives who were in World War II. I was a Southern boy, so I was going into service. It was just a matter of which branch, and that was that. And I have to say, I didn't think when I joined the PLC program in the Marine Corps right out of high school that I would end up in the midst of a war, but that's what I signed up for. So in my uncles and my father and all, a generation or two before in World War II. So it's a horrific thing, and people should do everything to avoid war, because you got somebody's son, brother, uncle, father, whose life is at risk. And when you lose one, I mean, there are two emotions. I mean, the grief is overwhelming because they're your comrade. They're the people that were just sharing the ground and sleeping on ponchos the day before. So it's overwhelming, but it is what war is all about. So you just have to compartmentalize it, but you never forget it. That's why I gave the speech on Veterans Day in 2022 to talk about six men whose names were on that wall to bring them back to life. Because, you know, the Native Americans say that nobody's really dead as long as somebody speaks their name. So as long as I'm alive, I'm going to speak the name of those men and tell their story, because they were courageous men who did their duty. A lot of people during those days did not. They didn't see it that way. And there's a big split in my generation over that. It's sort of forgotten now, but the fractious divide in the nation was much greater than it is now. then over the war and the draft and things like that. So it was a controversial time and a controversial war, but all of the opinion polls show that the people who served in Vietnam are proud of their service, and that includes me. And I'm sure that's the 99% of the people who went. And I think there's a special bond with Vietnam veterans because, as is very well reported and I personally experienced, people were mean as hell to us when we came back because they equated us with the war as the somehow. But that faded over time, I think partially because of the reflected glory of what our magnificent troops did in Desert Shield and Desert Storm and in 1991, and then later on after 2003, and the other operations like Grenada and Panama and so forth, because the American military distinguished itself in those campaigns. It didn't get bogged down in a sort of body count or exchanging casualties where the other side was willing to, you know, put their entire youth cohort at risk. So things began to change after 2003. We probably didn't do the best job in the way we conducted the Iraq or Afghanistan situations because we forgot the major lesson, and that is democracies don't do well supporting wars over a long period of time. And that's probably a good thing, in my opinion.
Now, thank you for sharing all that, sir. Can you recall any particularly challenging decisions you made as a rifle platoon commander, company commander, and how you navigated the decision-making process?
I think that infantry warfare is the ultimate example of having to carefully assess risk versus reward. And, you know, as Patton says in that fictional movie, you know, the secret about success in war is making the other guy die for his country and not you dying for yours. And it is that simple. So when you have objectives and the tactical plan, you have to execute it with a very particular regard for your resources, whether it's ammunition or water, but most importantly, your troops, not only because you're responsible for them and you have great affection for them, but they're the ultimate resource. So risk reward is what you're dealing with all the time. And usually when somebody got into trouble is they got too blasé about the risk and got themselves in a jam. So that's really the calculation of it, and to be competent with your tactics, the technologies you had at the time, which of course are laughably simple. I'm still amazed at going on 80 years of age that you can take a GPS on your phone and figure out where you are within 10 feet any place in the world. Most of the time in Vietnam, we were lost because we had these old French maps and we certainly didn't have any GPS. It was like being on the backside of the moon, for goodness sake. We didn't have drones, which have, of course, completely changed everything, as is being demonstrated every day in Ukraine. So I feel a little bit like somebody who was in the bows and arrow era, because all of the things that we did and the way we did them couldn't be done anymore because the technology won't allow it. It's not possible to run close air support 200-300 feet over your head, and you can't drop napalm, and it's outlawed, and you couldn't get the planes down there that low anyway, in any case, because it'd be shot down with Stinger-like missiles. So it's just a different ballgame, but the leadership principles are the same. Mm-hmm. And the Marine Corps has taught those same leadership principles since it was formed. And I can still recite in my head the 5-paragraph order, and I use it and have used it for 50 years in business to lay out what we're trying to do and why we're trying to do it, and the communications classes that I was taught in the Marine Corps, how to make your communications succinct and understandable. And of course, I guess I'm always guilty of that famed Marine Corps mantra, tell somebody what you're going to tell them, then tell them what you told them. You just got to make sure that what you've said is clearly understood, because the consequences are quite dire in a situation like Vietnam. Less so, thank goodness, in business, but even so, you've got to make sure what you're trying to accomplish is well understood by the people that work for you.
Sir, if we could go back to your experiences coming back to the United States, many Americans are treating Vietnam vets with disdain, disinterest. How do you navigate the challenges of returning home and then transitioning to civilian life. And do you have any advice you would offer to present day veterans maybe experiencing similar challenges?
Well, as I said a moment ago, war is the most despicable and inhumane thing that human beings can do one to the other, I guess, other than some sort of medieval torture. So once you've been through it, you've kind of got two paths that you can trod. One of it, you can just accept it, and it's a part of your life. And the other thing is that you can let the devil take over you, you know, and you can't get over it. There's only two choices, because I can promise you, once you've experienced it, it's going to stay with you. And that's true of the death of loved ones all the time. I lost a daughter. There's not an hour that goes by I don't think about her. There's not a day that goes by I don't think about those men I just described to you in Vietnam. But if it's going to rule your life for the remainder of your life, you're not going to be very productive, because there's no experience that you can equate with it. You just got to put it in the compartment and deal with it. That's the way I always tried to do it. I was very proud of service in the Marine Corps and my troops in particular. But for a long time, you just didn't talk about it, because it wasn't very popular to have served in Vietnam. In fact, I don't think I ever gave an interview about it until 2008. And it wasn't that I wasn't fine with talking about it. It was just, I was in business. I didn't see a lot of military people except occasionally. Kept in touch with a lot of my troops, bailed some of them out of jail, got lots of them jobs, sent them some money. I'd have done anything for those guys. But you just have to put it in perspective and move on with your life. Otherwise, it's going to consume you. And a lot of people, that's what happens, because it's no comparable experience, to my knowledge, that you can have.
Yeah. Sir, you've watched Ken Burns's documentary series on Vietnam. Would you share your thoughts on that series and its effect on you?
Well, Ken Burns is a fantastic filmmaker. I'm a great fan of his work, particularly The Civil War, which was narrated in part by a great friend of mine, the historian Shelby Foote, whom I knew very, very well. So I admire Ken's filmmaking. But the common view of Vietnam is it's a war we shouldn't have been in. That may be correct. And it's war that we could never have won. And that I significantly disagree with. And when General Abrams took over from General Westmoreland, he changed the tactics. And as I mentioned, President Nixon changed the strategy significantly, and he used our prodigious power to interdict the North Vietnamese supply chain. All the munitions that the North Vietnamese used came down the Sino-Viet Railroad, or they came through Haiphong Harbor, and we used B-52s as tactical weapons, what's called arc lights. They would drop tons and tons of bombs in the jungle. Well, what they did was to turn it around, and they put the B-52s up north. And that's really what brought the war to a close. Now, none of the things I just mentioned to you were impossible to do in 1965, 66, 67, 68. We just had this strategy of we're going to kill more of the North Vietnamese kids. And they were prepared, as General Giap subsequently said famously, to send them down and lose hundreds of thousands of them per year, which is what they were doing. So the mistake was that Vietnam was like Korea, where the Chinese were going to intervene, and as they famously did, and surrounded the 1st Marine Division at the Chosun Reservoir. And thanks to the courage of those troops, and they had great leadership with General O.P. Smith, and every Marine ought to read his biography by his daughter. It'll tell you a lot about how to manage men in a tough situation. But the strategy of the war was built on this could be another Korea and the Chinese are going to come in. They missed the fact that the Chinese and the Vietnamese had been mortal enemies for 1,000 years, and the likelihood of that was low. And so I just think in retrospect, having to develop a strategy for our business and being a student of history, the strategy of the war was incorrect. And so Ken Burns's film, which is The War Couldn't Have Been Won, it deals only within the context of the war as it was fought. Now, it would have been brutal, and it would have probably been reprehensible in certain ways, you know, just like some of the decisions made in World War II, the bombing of Dresden or the firebombing of Tokyo. But the war could definitely have been won. And I'm the first one to say, I might not be here talking to you had they pursued that, because God knows they might have taken the 3-5 and we made an amphibious assault on Hanoi. I don't know, but yeah. You get the point I made. We could have used our air power more decisively. They were picking tactical targets, as is well reported by General McMaster's book, Dereliction of Duty, in the White House, for goodness sake. I don't think they've learned much, because they're doing the same damn thing today and pulling their punches on assisting Ukraine and trying to second guess the IDF. I went with the IDF up in 1982 into Lebanon, and I'm a great admirer of those troops. And I don't think U.S. politicians have any idea what it's like on the ground and those kids are dealing with over there. So we ought to shut up and let them do what they need to do. They're fastidious in trying to avoid civilian casualties, as we were, by the way, contrary to people claiming otherwise. So I believe that's the way I would look at Ken Burns saying, fantastic film, but the fundamental premise that we shouldn't have been there, that may be right, because you got to be really motivated by some affront or some strategic instance, in my opinion, to put young men and women in harm's way up to and including the loss of their life. It better be damn important, because that's somebody's son or daughter or brother or father. But if you do it, then what you need to do it is decisively in the shortest period of time. And that's what we didn't do in Vietnam, and in retrospect, we didn't do in Iraq and Afghanistan, which caused them to be so controversial.
Thank you for sharing that, sir. Sir, if we could spend our remaining time talking about FedEx and leadership, I'd like to ask, you know, you've said elsewhere that Vietnam veterans largely built FedEx. Could you discuss their role in growing the company and your thoughts on vets in the workforce today?
At the time, I remember being a Vietnam veteran. Virtually any Vietnam veteran that wanted a job, they had one. I mean, they just had to say, if you could fly a plane or drive a truck or move a box, I mean, hell, I hired you. And then many of them matriculated up to high positions. My old partner, Jim Perkins, he was an Air Force officer of Vietnam. I could list all kinds of folks. They were well-trained in leadership. They were organized. They had a good work ethic and so forth. So perhaps it was just the fact that cohort of people roughly my age were the ones who built the company in the early days. But I recognize that every time I can. Our pilots were almost all Vietnam veterans in those days. And I think we had half a dozen POWs that came back and flew for us.
No kidding.
So I think it was probably more so because I'd been a Vietnam veteran, that we had so many of them. But I would say to you, and I've said over and over again, including in that Veterans Day speech in 2022, that so many Vietnam veterans went on to do outstanding things. They were senators and cabinet secretaries and authors and producers and doctors, and a lot of the NCOs, like my friend Dave Danford, one of my platoon leaders, went on to be a sergeant major. One of my best friends in the Marine Corps went on to be a 4-star general. So they had distinguished careers, even though the Vietnam veteran cohort was often depicted as sort of this broken, drug-addled group of people. And that just wasn't the case. It wasn't the case based on my own personal experience. It wasn't the case statistically either. But that's sort of the rap that the Vietnam veterans got over, you know, at least in the first decade or so after the war ended.
FedEx has long led in using cutting-edge technologies in its operations. What emerging technologies excite you most, and are there any that concern you?
Well, there's been so much spoken about AI, I almost hate to bring it up, but we have been a technological leader ever since the company got started. I had great partners, including one who wasn't in Vietnam, but he was a Vietnam-era veteran, Jim Barksdale, who was an IT genius, and we invented the ability to track and trace packages. Nobody had ever done that before in any kind of logistics system. And once you can see things when they're in motion as well as at rest, your whole ability to manage inventory changes. Then we did all kinds of things like developed the capability to basically see through fog with FLIR that allowed the reliability of our airplanes to be quantumly better than had been the case in the past. We were one of the biggest users of digital radio, moving information to and from the trucks and then into the offices of our customers. And now we are heavily involved using machine learning and AI, and we've been doing that for a number of years. In fact, with all this emphasis on AI, I think a little bit we're like that famous country and Western song, I was country before country was cool. Well, we were in AI and machine learning a long time before they talked about it all day long on CNBC. So we've always had technological prowess, and we recruited the finest people that we could find, and we have that today. And I think it's going to be profound in the things that it's going to do in lots of fields, but in the field that we're in, logistics and transportation, it's going to make it quantumly more efficient. It's going to make our customers' capabilities to run supply chains much better. It's going to improve safety, although every meeting at FedEx begins with the mantra, safety above all. That's consideration number one. So the world is going to be very different because of the ability to use this AI to see all types of things which were not discernible before, you know, that this is the place where the problem is occurring. And of course, it's going to revolutionize medicine, statistics, all kinds of businesses, finance. So that's going to be the big change. And I think the other, which applies both in the civilian and the military world today, if you can see something, you can hit it. If you go back to World War II, there's this wonderful program out on Masters of the Air about the 8th Air Force in Europe, an incredibly courageous group of people. But the strategy wasn't very good, and they dropped, you know, millions of tons of bombs and didn't do a damn thing except to kick up a lot of dirt. Well, you compare that with today when the United States fired a small precision missile from a drone having flown 1,500 miles to terminate Zawahiri, who was bin Laden's number two, and he was standing on the porch in Afghanistan, and the missile is so precise, it doesn't even badly damage the apartments on either side of it. Now, that's a long trek from World War II and the carpet bombing, the Masters of the Air, to the kind of technology. Well, down at the infantry level, if you can see somebody today, you can probably hit them. So that changes everything. So you've got to look at these technological developments with this processing of information and how you can stitch together patterns and discern things that you couldn't see before in whatever field you're in, medicine or logistics or the Marine Corps or what have you. It's going to change everything. And by the way, General Berger, Commandant of the Marine Corps, I guess once removed, he controversially, you know, modified a lot of things that the Marine Corps was doing because of those technologies. And I'm not an expert on it because I'm, you know, 50 years removed from the Marine Corps, but I've tried to keep up with it through friends and reading. And I think he was mostly right. In fact, I sent him a message after the Ukraine war started and you had all these incredible capabilities by the Ukrainians who were widely underestimated using these drones and stingers and javelins and popping open those Russian tank tops and so forth. I sent him a note. Said, you're a lot smarter now, aren't you? So some of the things he were doing were quite controversial, but you see the Houthis firing these missiles at naval ships, which the Marine Corps now has, I think, what they call littoral battalions, which are designed to do that. You see what the Ukrainians have done, keeping the port of Odessa open, you know, attacking naval shipping with no navy of their own. So all of these things that are going on in the civilian world are going to manifest themselves in a changed environment for the military as well.
If we could stay on the topic of future warfare and some of the changes that General Berger made, a certain problem in a war in the Pacific is contested logistics. And I'm curious if you have any insights or experiences from FedEx experiences as a worldwide logistics leader that might shed light on how to successfully execute contested logistics.
Well, that's a real problem because if you take that basic premise that if you can see it, you can hit it today. that brings at risk, you know, having LPHs or whatever the designation is, standing off and putting people in Amtraks or LCVPs and you know, hitting the beach in a traditional matter because you can't be visible for that period of time. Now, that could change the other way, you know, with lasers. And I read the works of Yigal Yadin, who was the vice chairman of the Israeli army when they won their independence. He was also an archaeologist, famously excavated Masada. So if you read his history of warfare in the biblical times, it's like reading today. You know, the offense gets the advantage because they have better bows and arrows, and then they develop armor and it shifts back and forth. That's what's going on right now. But I would say that the general principles are this: war is about logistics, and it's in particular about the movement of fuels. In fact, I think the greatest numbers of casualties that the U.S. experienced in Iraq were moving fuel on the roads, which were subject to IEDs and so forth. And an M1 Abrams tank, as I recall, got, let's see, what was it? 1 gallon would get you, what, a quarter mile or something like that. It was incredible, the fuel consumption. So moving these tankers on the road was highly dangerous. So I'm not up to speed on exactly what the philosophies are today about how to operate, but suffice it to say, you're going to have a very low observable footprint, and your logistics are going to have to be done in a very adept way where your transport assets are not exposed to being targeted. So that's what the professionals in the military do today. And Marine Corps has always been about combining really, you know, infantry, air, in many cases as airborne artillery, and logistics. And those MOSs are kind of the core MOSs of the Marine Corps. So I don't know what the Marine Corps is doing, but I sat through a lunch one day with some friends that included a lot of retired Marines, my generation, and maybe the one or two behind us, and then some of the young officers who are working on these new strategies. And they sort of got into a debate, but just listening to it as a casual observer, I guess you'd call, or a semi-educated observer, I thought the younger officers who'd been working on these plans and technologies and all carried the day. And some of the premises that some of the traditionalists were worried about, I think were correct. But I think the wisdom of making the Marine Corps lighter and more lethal, I guess you would say, with a lower footprint for its logistics was the right thing to do based on where technology is going.
Sir, before FedEx took off, the company nearly went bankrupt in October 1973 due to the Arab oil embargo. Could you talk about that crisis, how you led the company through that time, and what advice might you have to leaders, whether it's a platoon commander, a Fortune 500 CEO, on leading their people through similarly challenging times?
It was a very traumatic event, and it would be best described, I think, as what is commonly called, at least in financial circles, a black swan event. I mean, nobody saw it coming. I mean, you got to remember, World War II was mostly about oil. I mean, the Japanese attacked the United States in Pearl Harbor because we stopped their oil coming up from Indonesia. Some of the biggest battles in the European theater, the famous low-level raid on Ploiești, Romania, was about oil, and on down the line. Well, the United States, I think, provided about almost 90% of all the oil for the Allies to win World War II. By the early 1970s, a lot of people thought we were running out of oil. We were importing a lot of oil from the Middle East, and in reaction to the Yom Kippur War, the Israeli war that went on there, the Saudis and the Arab states cut off the oil to the United States, which brought enormous amounts of trauma. Well, we had just begun, and the United States set up an allocation system that you could buy fuel for your business based on what your historical use was. Well, of course, our historical use was zero. And so I had to become a real song and dance man, I can tell you that much, up in Washington, convincing the administrator of this fuels agency to give us an allocation. He's a wonderful man named John Sawhill. But our plan had been very well put together. I'd done three separate marketing studies, so we knew the market was there and it was just temporary. So we had to raise more money. It was very expensive, but it didn't take the fundamental premise of the, didn't put it into question. It was just a matter of the price of the fuel. So it delayed our profitability by about 18 months. Now, having said that, I think the lessons for that is always expect a black swan event. And you're not going to know where it's coming from because it is a black swan event. It's something you didn't foresee. But I think it's also indicative of kind of what I learned in the Marine Corps is, all right, don't go crying about your problems, adapt and go deal with it. And which is what I did. I had no political power whatsoever. I just had to make our case, which we did successfully. So that would be, to me, the big issue of that. Now, having said that, because we use so much fuel, I know the oil markets and what's gone on. And one of the most remarkable things that's changed geopolitics completely is the oil fracking revolution in the United States. We're now, again, like we were in the 60s and before that during World War II, when we were supplying most of the oil for the Allies, we're now an exporter of oil and gas. And the Marine Corps has been reconfigured to retake these islands in the Pacific that the Chinese have militarized, having told President Obama famously that they would not. That's why the Marine Corps is reconfiguring. If the Marine Corps gets the order to do so, it will have to take those islands back. Well, why are those islands so important? It's because the vast majority of the oil that China consumes comes through the Malacca Straits, you know, around Singapore. So our submarines during World War II essentially blockaded Japan, and it went back to being a prehistoric society because they had no oil. That's what the Chinese fear in the Pacific and why the Marine Corps is configuring itself to take the islands back if given the order to do so. A big part of the relationship between President Xi and President Putin is about oil, because they can no longer sell their oil in Europe. The Russians cannot. And so they're completely shifting to try to sell oil and gas to China. So China's no longer dependent on oil coming up the Malacca Straits from the Middle East. But the Middle Eastern countries, particularly Iran and Saudi, they're selling much more oil into Asia in general and China than they are to us today. So the whole geopolitical situation has changed because of oil and the fact that we got a real dose of reality about it during the Arab oil embargo has made it something I've made it a point to be very, very knowledgeable about in all the years since.
As FedEx expanded into the worldwide organization it is now, did you find your approach to leadership changing? Are there any things that you do now that you didn't do 30 or 40 years ago?
No, of course. I mean, for one thing, the workforce in the United States is much more questioning. I mean, you got to tell people why much more than just do this or that. That was never really the case, as the Marine Corps taught you. I mean, most people hadn't been in the military, you know, conceive of people standing there and clicking their heels and like automatons doing what the officer and the NCO tells them. And it's completely opposite of that. I mean, it's servant leadership. If you do it right, you're trying to take care of your troops and trying to make sure they understand what they're going to do and why they need to do it, especially if it's dangerous to their health and survival. That's one thing. And then we deal with different cultures around the world. So the FedEx philosophy of people, service, profit came again right from the Marine Corps and that looking after your troops, as I've said over and over again, verbally and in writing on many, many different venues, that everything we accomplish at FedEx is because of what I learned in the Marine Corps. But I think there are some truisms that are making a difference, what your religion are, might be, your ethnicity. I mean, the golden rule is constant and it's found in every religion and every culture. So we try to treat people fairly, and we try to do right by them, and we try to give them opportunity, and we try to give them a sense of mission, because we're moving the most important and critical items in the world every day. And it has worked. You have to modify it a bit differently in this country or that country, but as long as you stay true to your values, then you're going to be able to deal with people pretty much across the board in the same way, adapting to culture and things of that nature. And that's what the Marine Corps is so good about, is it teaches you how to lead people, how to deal with them, you know, so they're part of the team. That's what we call our folks, teammates, because we're all playing on the same team. A lot of people try to talk about business as a family or, you know, whatever the current mantra of the day. It's the Marine Corps was a team. I mean, that's the way it refers to itself, the air ground team, the Marine Corps team.
Yeah.
That's what I always used. And I learned that in sports, but I particularly learned it in the Marine Corps. And I'm sure it's being taught the same way today.
Sir, you are a voracious reader. What sort of books do you typically read, and what value do you think reading has for leaders? How is reading maybe specifically influenced your leadership at FedEx?
Well, it's amazing how something you learned in another discipline that's not your core competency can come to play in your own business. For instance, I mentioned early on the invention by FedEx of a system to track and trace packages. Well, what we did is we adopted the same type of technology that was used to put barcodes on products in supermarkets. You know, I'm a can of Campbell's soup. Well, nobody had ever used that technology to make sequential numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, so on. So we took that technology, which I was very familiar with because I'd been on the board of two consumer products companies, and that's where it came to. Well, let's adopt that technology and develop small scanners. We can keep up with these things as they're going through the system. Nobody had ever done that. So all kinds of things that can be successful in one setting come from a completely different setting. That's why you want to read history, I think. That's why you want to stay up to date on the key developments of science and human nature. It doesn't change much. It modifies it a little bit. So I would recommend to anybody to be a scholar of history. In terms of leadership, there's nothing new under the sun. The Macedonians under Alexander the Great, the Romans, the U.S. Marine Corps, the paratroopers, they all teach the same thing. It's been true since the beginning of recorded time. So read the stories of the great captains. Read about George Marshall. Read about Nimitz. Both of them were modest, unassuming men, as was General O.P. Smith of Peleliu and Chosun fame, and see how they conducted their affairs. And of course, in the Marine Corps setting, arguably our greatest scholar was, you know, General Mattis. And I'd get General Mattis's reading list, which is in, I think, the bibliography of Call Sign Chaos, if not, and see what he read, because he ended up pretty good as a 4-star and then the Secretary of Defense. And he's a great, great guy, too. I can see how he became both of those. Finally, I'd have a little understanding of, you know, where we all came from and keep things in perspective. I reread recently Sapien by Harari. You know, if you read that book, it's like things aren't so complicated after all. I mean, this thing really makes a lot of sense as to how we got where we are. So I've just always found that reading was very important. I grew up without a father, so I think biographies were particularly important to me. And then learn from people whom you admire, which in my case included my three uncles, all of who were World War II veterans. And I think they taught me almost as much as the Marine Corps did about how to conduct yourself appropriately. So that'd be my suggestion on the self-education and reading.
Sir, thank you truly for your time. It's been an eye-opening, insightful conversation. As I ask all my guests, do you have any parting thoughts or shots for our listeners, especially active duty NCOs, staff NCOs, and company grade officers?
If you go to the Marine Corps Museum at Quantico, which I had the honor of being the co-chairman of building along, raising the funds for that building along with Bud Baker, who was CEO of Wachovia Bank, had been a Marine and proudly so like me. In the rotunda there, you'll see a lot of quotes engraved on the wall. Nimitz's quotes about Iwo Jima, you know, uncommon valor was a common virtue and things like that. There's one little section there that was written by an Army general who Truman had sent over to Korea. And he said, there wasn't any safer place to be in the Korean War than behind a Marine platoon. So the Marines that are listening to this radio broadcast are standing on the shoulders of a lot of great men. And if called upon to ply your trade, you know, don't let those men down in the past. You've been trained well. You got the best comrades in arms on either side of you. And all I can say to them is Semper Fidelis.
Sir, thank you again.